Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for January 15th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a new catalyst that captures carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, using parasitoid wasps for biocontrol and biomedicine, and innate versus adaptive immunity. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about cosmetics made from lead, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Compared to oxygen, carbon dioxide isn't very reactive. Add to that that there's a lot more oxygen in our atmosphere than carbon dioxide, and you begin to see why scientists were surprised when a material they were researching turned out to react with carbon dioxide instead of oxygen when exposed to air. In a paper in this week's Science, Elizabeth Bowman and colleagues report how their team's catalyst stitches two carbon dioxide molecules together into what's called an oxalate, capturing carbon dioxide and pulling it out of the atmosphere. The research suggests a possible future method for removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, counteracting emissions that are influencing the climate. I spoke with Bowman from her office at Leiden University in the Netherlands.
Well, I have found a solution containing a copper complex, which turns green in contact with air. And normally that would mean that the copper had reacted with oxygen, but we found unexpectedly that it had reacted with the traces of carbon dioxide that is in the air. This is an unusual reaction because oxygen is much more reactive than CO2 normally. And the interesting thing that we found is that we can recover the complex to make it a copper one complex again, and then it starts the reaction all over again.
So it's acting then as a catalyst?
It acts as a catalyst, yes.
And how much of the catalyst is recovered after each reaction?
Well, we have done 6 cycles, and then 99% of the catalyst is recovered after each cycle.
So is there a possibility of scaling this process up to catalytically remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in meaningful ways for climate change?
Well, maybe in the long term, but at this moment, the complex is by far not active enough because it takes us 6 hours to do 6 turnovers. So from one molecule, you then have 12 molecules of oxalate, which in 6 hours is not really very much. So we need to optimize the electron transfer and the rate of the whole reaction.
Now, oxalate is 2 carbon dioxides stuck together. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And what then would you be able to do with this product in terms of carbon sequestration as oxalate?
Well, oxalate can be used just in the lab. Oxalic acid, for instance, is a chemical that is present in household chemicals. It's present in household liquid that you use for removal of rust. And if you take oxalic acid and you can reduce it further to ethylene glycol, then you have something that is used as an antifreezant in, for instance, your car, the spray that you use to wipe your windows in the car to prevent it from freezing in the winter. It contains ethylene glycol.
Now, separating the oxalate and getting it to this form, does it just come right off the copper catalyst, or is there another step involved?
Well, the copper catalyst captures the CO2 into its molecule and then makes oxalate. And there it's forming a very stable complex, and that's, I think, the driving force of this reaction. So we have to remove the oxalate, and we do that by adding a lithium salt. And the lithium salt that we add is soluble in the solvent that we use, but the lithium oxalate is not. So the driving force then is the precipitation of the lithium oxalate. And then we are left with a copper complex, which is empty. And this copper complex we can easily reduce with a low potential to the original copper one complex. And then that starts capturing CO2 again.
Now, lithium is fairly rare. So the question then becomes how to separate the oxalate from the lithium?
Well, if you have lithium oxalate, you can easily add an acid and then you have make another lithium salt again in oxalic acid. So you can recover the lithium from the lithium oxalate. But I'm quite sure that we can do the same reaction with sodium salt.
So what's then the rate limiting step to speeding up this process to capture lots of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere quickly?
I think the most difficult part at this point, or the rate limiting step, is the electron transfer from the electrode to the copper. So although the potential is quite low, so we don't need a lot of energy, the copper complex has to be in the close vicinity of the electrode surface in order to be reduced. So I think that is the rate determining step.
How did you and your team come across this copper complex in the first place? Were you investigating carbon dioxide sequestration?
No, this was a total surprise. We were investigating the same ligand for nickel to make models for nickel enzymes, and it's a specific nickel enzyme that is able to convert superoxide radicals. Those are dangerous radicals. And superoxide dismutase rapidly converts the superoxide into more harmless molecules. So we were investigating the nickel compounds, but usually we then also simultaneously investigate, for instance, zinc and copper compounds to see if we can learn more about a specific system. So, and then the copper compound unexpectedly reacted with carbon dioxide. Well, it normally reacts with oxygen.
So have you and your team attempted to capture carbon dioxide from the air using the nickel or zinc complexes from your original experiment, or the copper was just a rare case out of these three?
We never tested it for nickel, but I don't expect nickel to do anything with carbon dioxide. It really has to do something with the specific oxidation states of copper 1, copper 2, whereas that for nickel, the different oxidation states are much harder to obtain. So nickel in different redox states is much less reactive than the copper.
What's the next step for your group in pursuing this research? Or are you just publishing it at this point to pass on to others and going back to your original experiment?
Well, we will go back to the original experiment. But on the other hand, I am now a student working on making small changes in the organic fragment of the complex to see how it influences this reaction, whether it can be made faster or more specific or less specific, to understand more what is happening with changing the compound by small steps. So we know what is present in the solution. What we don't understand is why it happens, and that's what we need to investigate.
Elizabeth Bowman, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for this interview.
Elizabeth Bowman of Leiden University is lead author of a paper on the electrocatalytic carbon dioxide conversion to oxalate by a copper complex.
I decided to look at parasitoid wasps because the genome of one has just been sequenced, and that's what we just published.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi reports on the uses of the parasitoid wasp for biocontrol, biomedicine, and as a model organism. In addition to the news story, this week's issue includes a paper by the Nasonia Genome Working Group on the genomic sequence of several species of the parasitoid wasps.
Well, it's a genome of one plus two more, basically. They started out sequencing the genome of one and then decided they could squeeze the sequences of two more wasps. And I didn't really know anything about parasitoid wasps, and I thought, okay, what are they? What do they do? How do they work? And it turns out they're really cool. For one thing is people haven't really figured out how many species of these wasps there are. But when they look, they're finding that there are many more species than they expected. And some think there are even more species of parasitoid wasps than there are species of beetles, which are sort of the most specious insects, supposedly. But now these little wasps that you can hardly see, they might be the most specious. So I thought, well, that's pretty cool.
How many species are we talking about?
How many species? We don't really know. There's 50 to 60,000 that are named, but there are probably hundreds of thousands more.
Why are scientists interested in the genetic sequence of these parasitoid wasps?
For several reasons. One, the wasp is used in agriculture to control agricultural pests. It's a form of biological control that's been extremely successful. There also might be some biomedical applications. Some of the wasp proteins might be useful in biomedicine. And then some of the wasp genes are genes that are found in humans, and so the study of those genes might help us understand those genes in humans.
So it has potential as a model organism.
It has potential as a model organism. It's easy to raise in the lab, and it has haploid males, which means the males have only one set of chromosomes, and that makes genetic analysis of those chromosomes a lot simpler. So people can learn about gene interactions. They can learn about the genes themselves a little bit easier.
Any surprises in the genome sequence?
Well, they were surprised, for example, to see how many venom proteins there were. There were far more than they expected. They were also surprised to see that the wasp had a full complement of what's called the methylation genes. These are genes whose proteins are important for turning the specific genes in the genome off sort of in a semi-permanent way. And another thing that was a surprise is how fast the mitochondrial genes are changing. They're changing about a rate about 35 times faster than the nuclear genes. And say in fruit flies, the mitochondrial genes are still faster, but they're only changing at a rate of about 7 times as fast as the nuclear genes. So this means these wasps diverge into new species very quickly.
Well, because of that fast-changing speciation, do scientists have any concern that this parasitoid wasp is stable enough for comparative studies over decades, given that they're evolving so quickly?
I don't think they have any concern. Fast is not that fast.
Okay. To the other reasons you mentioned for why scientists are particularly interested in these parasitoid wasps, biocontrol and agriculture, you said they're good at controlling pests. How do they go about doing that?
So parasitoid wasps work by basically the females lay their eggs or inject their eggs into caterpillars or pupa or eggs of other insects and other arthropods. And those eggs develop into larvae that basically feed off of the pupa or the caterpillar that they're living in, and in doing so destroy that pupa or caterpillar. What makes them good for biocontrol is many of the wasps are very specific. They only lay their eggs in one or two species of caterpillar, so that if you have a caterpillar that's a pest, and if you can find the right parasitoid wasp to introduce into the area, you can control the pest without affecting other insect species.
And this strategy has been used effectively?
It's been used very effectively. One of the most striking successes was in Africa in the 1970s. A bug called the mealybug invaded Africa and started affecting cassava, which is a root that many Africans survive on in lean times. They grow it and they harvest the root, and it's very nutritious. And this mealybug came from South America and basically within a short period of time was taking 80% of the crops. And what the international agricultural researchers did is they introduced a wasp that was able to control the mealybug and make it no longer a problem.
Any concerns that introducing a new species into an environment it's not from would cause problems, say, for the surrounding ecology?
There's always those concerns. And right now, the people who are involved in sort of using wasps for biocontrol measures go through a long, extensive testing period to try and assess whether or not the wasp will sort of spread its host preferences so that it will start attacking other caterpillars that it didn't before. And so they do a lot of work beforehand to make sure that it won't have a negative impact on the environment.
Now, to the third reason you said that scientists were interested in these parasitoid wasps, biomedicine. All these species of wasps have venom, and you mentioned that they were surprised by the number of venom genes that are in these wasps. Is that what the potential biomedicine use is?
So the venom is interesting in that it doesn't kill the insect host. It will cause it to basically anesthetize it, or it will make it move in a specific way.
Physically move?
Yeah, apparently so. And so the molecules, the proteins that are involved sort of have unusual features. And so they found 79 of these venom proteins, 23 of which no one had ever seen any place else in any other organism. And this gives them sort of an entree into investigating molecules that affect paralysis and other functions. And it could possibly have some utility for humans.
Elizabeth Panisi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi on the study and potential uses of the parasitoid wasp for biocontrol, biomedicine, and as a model organism. Find the article, as well as the paper by the Nasonia Genome Working Group, reporting three wasps' genomic sequences in this week's issue. Also in this week's Science, a special section on innate immunity.
Innate immunity is a very rapid response to invading microbes, and it's nonspecific.
That's Science Associate Editor Kristen Mueller, who edited the papers for this special section. Here's an excerpt from our interview on innate immunity.
In contrast, adaptive immunity takes on the order of several days to get going and is highly specific to the type of pathogen that the body's encountering.
Now, there are four papers in the special section on innate immunity. As editor of this special section, how did you solicit them?
So I started with both what's been going on recently in the field and then also thinking more historically. And about 20 years ago, Charles Janeway posited that there is the existence of this immune system, the innate immune system, which is required for the activation of the adaptive immune system for T and B cells. T and B cells, each being immune cells that actually have immunological memory. And so when you re-encounter a microbe, they respond faster and you don't actually feel like you're getting sick. And so it was known that those types of cells respond when you get infected. But the issue was the things that activated them, you needed something more to go along with what an immunologist knew at that time activated them. And so Charles Janeway came up with a theory that actually you need a specific recognition of the microbe or the virus or the bacteria that the body's encountering in addition to this what's called antigen or bits of protein that activate, for example, T cells. And so he made this hypothesis that it's really the combination of these two factors that are needed to get the adaptive immune response going. And so thus the field of innate immunity was born. And so what I wanted to do in soliciting the papers for this special issue was talk about the research that has been going on for the last 20 years, which is trying to identify these various receptors that do recognize patterns in microbes. So the first two papers deal with receptors that recognize these various microbes, either the RIG-I family of receptors or the NLR family of receptors. And then the last two papers, one of them deals with how the innate immune system actually then activates the adaptive immune system. And then finally, I have a paper that examines how the innate immune system plays a role in diseases that aren't typically associated with the immune system, such as type 2 diabetes.
Let's take them each in turn, starting with this RIG-I paper you mentioned and the receptors that are involved in recognizing microbes. Mm-hmm. What more specifically is that about?
So the major function of this RIG-I family of receptors is to detect viral infection. And so viruses are composed of nucleic acids, which are something that is normally present in a cell in your own body. And so the issue that's going on is that in a cell, you have to have receptors that are able to distinguish the viral RNA in this case from the RNA that's present normally in the cell. And so the big question in the field has been, well, how is this done? What's specific about the RNA from viruses that allows this family of receptors to sense that? And so this perspective by Ray Winkle et al. Examines how the RIG-I family of receptors then is able to distinguish viral RNA from host RNA. So then since this field is only 20 years old, and these receptors have really only been a focus of research for the last 3 or 4 years, we're really beginning to understand then the molecular secrets of how the host is sensing viruses.
Okay, so next paper, this one's about NLRs. What are these and how are they discovered?
The next paper is by Jenny Ting and colleagues, and it focuses on another family of receptors that are able to recognize microbes. And in this case, they primarily recognize bacteria and viruses. And this family of receptors was found through the process of genomic mining by taking conserved stretches of DNA within these genes and then searching for these conserved stretches of DNA through different species. And so they were able to find that these conserved regions of DNA were found in different varieties of plants all the way up to mammals.
So these NLR proteins are recognizing viruses or bacteria in the same way, whether the innate immune system is in a plant or in an animal, potentially.
So potentially, plants and mammals are using the same mechanisms to recognize infection with different microbes. And so the major questions now is actually trying to figure out if these receptors are directly sensing the microbes when these different cell types are infected, or if there's some intermediary signaling pathways that are emanating from these receptors that are allowing the detection of these different microbes. And then another big question is that there are so many family members and there's so many different signaling pathways that appear to be activated by these receptors. A lot of research is just focusing on trying to figure out which specific microbes elicit which different pathways and how such specificity can be gained through these different receptors.
That was an excerpt of an interview with Science's Kristen Mueller, who edited the special section on innate immunity in this week's issue. To hear the rest of the interview, please visit www.sciencemag.org/special/immunity. If you have any feedback on this segment of the show, our first interview of a research editor, please let us know by writing us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. And thanks. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about cosmetics made from lead. That sounds pretty dangerous, Dave.
It does sound dangerous, Rob, especially when we know that lead is a highly toxic metal. Recent studies have shown that lead exposure can cause everything from brain damage to miscarriages. Yet it looks like the ancient Egyptians were spreading it all over their eyes.
Why were they doing that?
Well, ancient manuscripts suggest that the ancient Egyptians used lead salts as treatments for eye ailments, scars, and discolorations. In other words, they thought for some reason that lead had a bit of a medicinal or even a cosmetic value. They didn't know what we know about lead today. But researchers wondered, well, was this just ignorance on their part, or was there actually something about lead that may have actually been effective for these purposes?
That would presume, I suppose, that the ancient Egyptians didn't ever suffer from having lead on their skin.
And that's probably the case. A lot of times, a lot of the bad effects we see with lead come from prolonged exposure. And since in those days, a lot of people didn't live past their 30s, they may not have seen a lot of the deleterious effects of lead that we see today.
So how did scientists test or study whether or not this lead exposure actually was beneficial to the ancient Egyptians?
Well, they weren't going to go around putting lead on people's eyes. So what they did is they did the next best thing. They took cells, which are called keratinocytes, and these are skin cells. And they grew them in addition to the lab, and they added some of these same types of salts that the Egyptians would have used in their eye makeup. And what they found is that when they did this, the cells started producing a lot of nitric oxide. Now, nitric oxide is known to set off a series of biochemical processes in the cell and in the body that are involved with combating diseases. For example, nitric oxide can prompt macrophages, which are these cells that eat bacteria, to the site of an infection. And researchers think that's probably not what's happening here, because on the surface of the skin, you wouldn't expect these macrophages all of a sudden be bursting from the surface and, you know, trying to kill eye bacteria. But they think that potentially the nitric oxide itself could have been helpful. Nitric oxide can actually break down bacterial proteins and even bacterial DNA. So if you've got an eye disease caused by bacteria and you've got the cells around your eyes making a lot of nitric oxide, that may actually help combat the disease.
So this would be a temporary treatment, potentially harming you, but harming the bacteria more.
Exactly. But Rob, all this gets to an idea called hormesis, which to me sounds Egyptian, but maybe it's not. I have no idea what the derivation of the word is. But basically what it means is that there are certain exposures, say a chemical, where there's just the right window of exposure, where if you give too much of something, then it's bad for you, say too much lead or lead for too much time. But if you use just a little bit of it, it may have benefits that outweigh the costs. Now, the researchers say we should all start putting lead in our eye makeup, especially because, as we talked about earlier, we live a lot longer than the ancient Egyptians did, and exposure for a long period of time is probably not a good thing. But for the ancient Egyptians, they may have fit well into this narrow window where the amount of time that they were using lead for, it may have had more pros than cons.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking about eyes, this next story is about why, when people have migraines, seeing light tends to make the migraine a lot worse. It causes them a lot more pain than the migraine itself does. And the mystery is that the brain regions that govern vision aren't tied to those that govern pain. Because this research is so tied to vision, what the researchers did in this study, which was really interesting, is they said, let's just recruit blind volunteers. And they recruited 20 blind individuals. Now, not all these individuals were completely blind. In other words, some of them couldn't see at all. They had had their eyes removed or their optic nerve was completely destroyed, so they couldn't even see any light at all. And some of them could see shades of light. They still had enough of the vision cells left in their eyes that they could sort of, you know, make out whether the room was light or dark, but maybe not a whole lot beyond that.
So blind and legally blind.
That's a good way to put it. And what they found is that the people that were completely blind, and by the way, all these people were also migraine sufferers. And what they found is that the people that were completely blind, not surprisingly, when they were having migraines and researchers shined a bright light, they didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. In other words, they didn't notice any more pain because they didn't even know the lights had been turned on. But the other individuals did have this increased pain, the individuals that could make out shades of light in a room. And the researchers said, okay, that tells us something really interesting because these individuals have, even the individuals that can make out shades of light in the room, have faulty rods and cones. And these are the cells in the retina that allow us to see clearly. So it can't be the rods and the cones that are contributing to pain. But what the volunteers did have that was still intact was cells that expressed a receptor called melanopsin. Now, melanopsin doesn't help people see shapes, but it does react to light, specifically blue light. And what the researchers did from there was they looked in rats and they looked at cells that were expressing melanopsin. And lo and behold, they found that these cells link up with other cells that transmit pain. So this seems to be the connection. It's not the normal cells that we traditionally think of, those cells that are involved in vision that cause migraine sufferers or increase pain when they see light. It's these other cells that express melanopsin that are causing this link between light and pain.
So did the researchers then go back to the legally blind volunteers and shine red light on them and see if that caused pain or not?
I don't think they went any further than the blue light scenario. And an outside researcher says that some of these blind people may actually still have some of their rod and cone cells intact. And it could still be that these cells are contributing to this light-induced pain. So this isn't the final word, but it's the closest researchers have come so far to figuring out why people that have migraines also have this really strong sensitivity to light.
Okay, so last one. What's this last story about?
Well, Rob, this last story is a bit of a fun one. It's about trying to find a way to make oil droplets navigate a maze just like a laboratory rat would.
Well, a laboratory rat is making decisions. I presume the oil droplets are not.
They're not making decisions, but even though they don't have a brain, researchers have found a way to make them surprisingly good at navigating a complex maze.
Why would researchers want oil droplets to navigate a maze in the first place?
Well, that's a good question, Rob. And the answer has to do with cancer therapies. A lot of new cancer therapeutics involve tying very toxic cancer drugs to various nanoparticles and other so-called vehicles. And the idea would be that these vehicles would help the drug get to where it needs to go in the body. So in other words, if you've got a tumor lodge deep within the recesses of your body, you don't want to take a drug that's going to go everywhere because that drug is going to hurt a lot of your cells. You really want that drug to go specifically to where that tumor is.
So the maze then is our network of arteries and capillaries.
Exactly. The maze is sort of a stand-in for the complexities of the internal workings of our body. And so what the researchers were trying to do is that they were trying to see if they could find a way to have a simple component, in this case an oil droplet, find its way through a complex maze.
So what technique then was involved in getting these oil droplets to follow this complicated maze?
Well, it's a bit complicated, but bear with me. The researchers created these tiny little mazes made of silicon, and they filled the mazes with a basic solution of potassium hydroxide. And on the exit part of the maze where they wanted the droplet to go, they placed this blob of gel, which was soaked in hydrochloric acid. So it's this very acidic thing was placed at the end of the maze. And at the beginning of the maze, they placed the droplet, which was either a mineral oil droplet or an organic solvent. But both of these droplets were mildly acidic. Now, what happens is that this maze exit where this big, very acidic gel is sitting, the acid starts to leak into the basic solution, and it creates this gradient where the maze route, so the route from the entrance of the maze to the exit of the maze, is traced out by this gradient of acidity. And basically what you have is you have a lot more acidity at the end of the maze than at the beginning of the maze. So now let's go back to the beginning of the maze. You've got this mildly acidic little droplet and this very basic solution around it. And without getting into all of the gory details, what essentially happens is the mild acidity of that droplet interacts with the alkalinity of the solution and creates sort of a surface tension pull on the droplet, which essentially pulls the droplet through the maze as it sort of follows this gradient until it reaches the very acidic gel lump at the end of the maze and is essentially, at that point, worked its way out of the maze. And you can actually see a really cool video of this happening on the site.
So how does this gradient and acidity and all this stuff relate to treating cancer?
Well, the idea with cancer is that areas of the body that have a lot of cancer cells in them are also highly acidic. So again, we're dealing with this scenario where we've got sort of the end of the maze. In this case, the cancer cell that you want to target is a very acidic region versus the rest of the body. So the researchers say, well, maybe we can, if there's a similar gradient phenomenon happening in the body, we would just need something as simple, probably not something as simple as an oil droplet, but something that could react very similarly to the way the droplets are reacting in this maze, where it would sort of follow a path through the body until it reached this very acidic cancer region.
So early days for this kind of research. Of course, the maze in the research isn't being pumped through with blood.
Right. The maze they created in this study is far, far simpler than the labyrinth of our body. And this is still at a very early stage, but it's a promising new approach to, again, trying to find a good way to target these cancer therapies so that the whole body doesn't have to deal with them, but rather that they're like a heat-seeking missile and they only go to the part of the body that really needs the drug.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome, the sex chromosome, only males have a Y chromosome, hasn't gotten a lot of respect. But it turns out it is a hot spot of evolution, and we've got a story all about that. And also a story about why alligators breathe like birds. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a number of fascinating policy stories, as usual, including a fight over Incan treasure and the controversy surrounding an Iranian physicist who was killed earlier this week in a bomb blast. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the January 15th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.